Bienvenue à la balado-diffusion sur Radio Créon du colloque sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard qui s'est tenu à Montréal en mai 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast on Radio Créon of the conference on the Bouchard-Taylor report that took place in Montreal in May 2009.
Voilà le relais, Jean-Claude Tremblay approuve à Richard qui cherche mot de l'œil. La passe est ici, il est seul. Il lance.
Vous allez voir ça, vous allez nous aimer.
Je voudrais profiter de l'occasion, comme j'ai le micro pour une dernière fois, pour remercier Martin Blanchard et Will Kalish qui sont ici et qui ont énormément travaillé pour que ce colloque puisse se dérouler dans de si bonnes conditions. Excusez-moi. Donc, je les remercie en votre nom. Donc, on en arrive à la dernière séance, qui est la séance de synthèse. Et donc, je vais vous présenter la co-organisatrice de ce colloque, Anna Karastatis, qui est titulaire d'un doctorat en philosophie de l'Université McGill, postdoc donc au Créum cette année, l'année qui est en cours, avec un projet de travailler justement sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard. Et je suis très heureux de l'annoncer, à partir du 1er septembre, professeur à l'Université California State à Los Angeles, donc une trajectoire fulgurante. Que celle de Anna. Alors, nous avons soulevé, le rôle qui est imparti à Anna est difficile et ingrat, c'est-à-dire que nous avons soulevé beaucoup de questions pendant un jour et demi. Anna a travaillé à essayer de les colliger littéralement à pied levé pendant que nous discutions, et elle me garantit qu'elle va répondre absolument à toutes les questions pendant sa synthèse, de sorte qu'au départ, tout sera clair et nous n'aurons absolument plus aucune interrogation sur ces questions. Blague à part, me fait grand plaisir de donner la parole à Anna.
Merci. Non, pas du tout. rather, the comments I'm going to make stem very much from my own interests in this debate. I was very happy to hear the discussions that have been going on over the last couple of days, and I just want to pick out, it's not systematic, but three themes that I saw recurring. That is the theme of myths and kinds of mythologies that the commission and the report and the whole debate has participated in reproducing, in addressing, in undermining, or revealing as myths. Then this question of racism, which we've been talking about a little bit in this last panel, well, quite a lot in this last panel, and a little bit throughout the conference. And then this question of reconciliation, which we haven't really touched upon except in the context of historical redress, but which, of course, forms the title of the report, and which came as a shock to many people, I think, who had some critiques about the report, the process, and the whole kind of framing of reasonable accommodation. So I'll talk about that at the end. So first, this question of myths. This has been a recurrent theme in our discussions, and particularly the relationship of myths and narratives to the nation-building project. So we've named a few here: the myth that multiculturalism is a federal strategy to control Quebec, the myth that immigration is out of control in Quebec, the myth that interculturalism represents a homegrown solution to both rather than a kind of imported or imposed one, the myth about the relationship of secularism to the emancipation of women in Quebec and in Western societies, and the corresponding myths about autonomy and culture that set up the opposition between multiculturalism and feminism in many accounts, many of which we heard Eleanor talk about. It's interesting that myths have been a topic of discussion here in our conference, because they're also what the report takes itself to undermine in large part, right? So myths about Islamic and other immigrant religious and cultural practices, myths about what or how much accommodation immigrants are actually demanding, myths that accommodation requests have proliferated beyond control, constituting a kind of crisis in Quebec. So these myths are fueled by anxieties about the threat to Quebec society that immigrants ostensibly pose. And we heard yesterday from Charles Taylor that at least one of the successes that he sees of the report has been that it has quelled many of the anxieties of the Francophone majority, that the forum the commission gave to Quebecois people to express these anxieties has contributed positively to their overcoming. So Taylor and Bouchard in the report argue that these anxieties stem from the ambivalent positioning of Quebec in Canada. And they chasten Quebecers, stop acting like a minority, start acting like the majority. And there are at least a couple of ways to interpret this. The most generous is that the report urges Quebecers to recognize, as Dominique Lédé put it yesterday, how privileged they are vis-a-vis minorities in their midst. So the most generous interpretation is that acting like a majority means being self-reflexive about one's location in relations of power. But they point out that relations of power have shifted in Quebec in the last 60 years, and that cultural and political and linguistic struggles of Francophone Quebecers have transformed their position within society. So the threat of cultural assimilation within Canada is not the same as it once was, and Quebecers' relations to immigrants cannot be informed by that anxiety or shaped by that anxiety. This is an interpretation of this prescription in the report that made many people who were from an anti-racist perspective quite critical of the project from the outset feel as though the commission was speaking to some of their concerns. So that's one interpretation of this. There's another interpretation of this, this one less generous. And we've heard this discussed a little bit in our last session. Accommodation as the gesture of power. So it is this gesture of the host toward the guest or toward the supplicant, and it's conditional on the will of the host, right? So even in thinking about it in terms of what issues interest the majority, right? What issues interest the minority? It's conditional on the will of the host, how this issue gets framed. So in Canada and Quebec, accommodation of differences, which are constitutionally recognized grounds of discrimination, are required by law. That is, while particular accommodation requests might be seen as unreasonable or unfeasible, given the constraints of workplaces in the capitalist market or of institutions, accommodation in general is a legal response to indirect and sometimes direct forms of discrimination. So it's part of law, right? And as Abigail Eisenberg argued yesterday, legal victories such as that in the Multani case and legal redress of historical dispossession or violation of rights specify matters in which there should be no compromise. Indeed, many of the proposals that came out in the heated debate about accommodation were about non-negotiable constitutional matters, matters settled not only by the Canadian Charter, but also the Quebec Charter. For instance, here I'm thinking one proposal, Pauline Marois' proposal to install a Quebec citizenship, which would require immigrants to Quebec to pass language and civics examinations. So two important things then that came out of the debate was the realization that first, accommodation requests are numerically few, and generally settled among and between the individuals involved. And second, that those requests that do end up in litigation are seeking legal recognition of a right already guaranteed by law. So accommodation is not some kind of favor bestowed on minorities by a beneficent majority, unless that's your view of the charter. And then I guess that's another argument. But rather a legal mechanism through which minority groups that are excluded by institutional design from the spheres of society, the many spheres of society, can exercise their existing right to participate in society. Nevertheless, while this is an important point to underscore, talk about accommodation in the public debate and to some extent in this report proceeded as though the kind of accommodation we're talking about is that of a host toward her guest, an asymmetrical relation in which the host decides on what terms to include or exclude her. I would argue, drawing on things that others have said here, that this construction of accommodation draws on a kind of fantasy of liberal Western subjects who see themselves reflected in the political, economic, and cultural institutions of their polity, not just here in Quebec, but this is, you know, virtually in all Western nations. It's a way of performing as well as securing their centrality and the legitimacy of their territorial control, which is a particularly contested issue in white settler societies like Quebec and Canada, under the guise of inclusion, tolerance, and respect for difference. So what I'm trying to get at, and what I think came up recurrently in our discussions, was that reasonable accommodation in these debates and in this report is a sign with a shifting referent. Accommodation, laïcité, multiculturalism, these are slippery terms. And in the last session, we had a debate about exactly what crisis is reasonable accommodation attempting to pick out. Is it a crisis in cultural practices and the conflicts between them? In religion? Is it racism? Exactly in what does the crisis consist? So similarly, Eleanor Lepinard argued that laïcité became the pretext or the sign in the 1990s in France to deal with the same anxieties about immigration, but with a non-immigrant target, second-generation immigrants who are French citizens, right? And Jean Bobéreau argued laïcité began to function as a sign of commitment to anti-sexism and secularism as a guarantor of women's rights. So we saw this very clearly in Quebec as well. And we heard from Tariq Modoud that multiculturalism itself has a shifting referent. Is it race? Is it culture? Is it religion? So he argued that this is in part due to the shifting self-identification of minoritized groups, but arguably that it has to do with shifts in nature of racism, right? Or at least in the kind of expression that racism is having. So this is not to try to fix the meaning of this debate to one issue, which we were saying in the last session is kind of a fruitless attempt, but rather to argue that race articulates with religion in this debate and with the divisions among feminists, for instance, about the oppressiveness of particular religions and practices like hijab to women. The broad point, then, is that reasonable accommodation has a kind of ambiguous connotation in terms of the relations of power that subtend it. It was clear from the interventions of members of the public grappling with this legal term that there was widespread confusion about its meaning, its scope, and its legal purview from the outset. And even in the report, reasonable accommodation becomes a concept that the authors eventually find too narrow to capture the range of practices they have set as their object of investigation. And here I'm not just talking about how they redefine the scope of the project or of the mandate, but rather the very use of the concept of reasonable accommodation in the analysis that they then perform of their object of investigation. So they introduce the broader concept of harmonization, a term which was virtually absent in public discourse and which I imagine might create some confusion also in terms of, okay, well, how does that relate to this kind of commonplace notion of reasonable accommodation in this Quebec context? And this notion of harmonization slides into reconciliation, which appears to the bafflement of many critical observers as the title of this report. But accommodation, harmonization, and reconciliation are not adequate, I would suggest, as others have, on their own, or sufficient, even with this kind of attention to discrimination, to provide an account of racism and the racialization of immigrant religious communities in Quebec. So Monique Deveau argued the report downplays the racialization of groups while emphasizing their religious identity. And she asks us, which problems and identities drop out from view in this kind of framing? What difference might it make to talk about racialization in this analysis? So this is just not about just personal forms of racism or occasional forms of racism, but the institutional and systematic forms of racism, rather than just informal racism of private employers or private citizens. And I want to connect this observation to another theme of our discussions, and that's the relationship of First Nations right within Canada and rights to accommodation accorded to members of immigrant minority groups. So in this connection, we heard from Abigail Eisenberg that if this commission had happened in Western Canada, and specifically in BC, it would center, rather than take entirely off the table, ongoing and historical colonialism, unsettled colonialism. From a race-critical perspective, the question of settler nationalism and its relation to Indigenous rights can't be separated from the role of immigration and nation-building. And it can't be separated historically either, I would say. As Monique Deveau argued, neither can questions of integration be separated from the fact of racism, from its prevalence, from its endemic structuring of Quebec society. But because the Bouchard-Taylor report defines racism exclusively as based on biological grounds, something we've also just discussed, which is one kind of racism, biological racism, but not racism in general. This means that cultural racism, the articulation of race with economic exploitation or gendered racism, complex processes of racialization become entirely invisible. In this way, then, a great deal of what constitutes contemporary racism is effaced by this narrow definition of racism as justified on the basis of biological difference. And that's the definition that the commissioners want to insist upon. And they actually say it's inaccurate to use the word racism to describe these other forms of racism I've just mentioned and that we discussed in the previous session. So the report, I think, does not sufficiently attend to these connections, which makes it difficult for many indigenous, immigrant, refugee, and migrant groups to see themselves and their experiences reflected in its analysis or in its recommendations. That's not to say that it doesn't make some positive recommendations, for instance, recognition of foreign diplomas. But it should be noted that this is a recommendation that comes out of the consultation process, right? That they could not but give audience to, because it was so prevalent a theme in the consultations in Montreal and to a lesser extent in Quebec City. But it overstates, I think, the importance of harmonization and reconciliation over equality and social transformation. And this has become apparent from the conversations I've had with immigrant groups like the Immigrant Workers Center in Montreal or the South Asian Women's Community Center, both of which in different ways participated in the Commission's consultation process. And in fact, in talking with some of the organizers in these groups, they said that we were forced to use an idiom, this idiom of reasonable accommodation, to talk about issues that actually don't fit within it at all. So it was a situation in which, as an anti-racist or as someone working for immigrants' rights, you were put in a position where you had to use this kind of idiom of reasonable accommodation to talk about issues of racism, but one that cannot serve the purpose of actually framing the issues in the way that they need to be framed if they're going to be resolved at all. So these issues, some of these issues that they wanted to have on the table included things like getting migrant domestic workers recognized as workers eligible for rehabilitation services in case of injury under the CSST, or addressing police violence and murder of racialized youth, or challenging the sexism of immigration laws which construct women as dependents of male independent class migrants and often trap them in abusive intimate relationships, or halting the expansion of temporary worker programs under the Conservative government, or the repealing of security certificates which have been deemed unconstitutional by courts, or as Tariq Madood mentioned with respect to Muslims in Britain, and this is largely the view here as well, ending the wars of aggression in which Canada is participating. But none of these are really dealt with to any satisfaction in the analysis of the recommendations of the report. And in this connection, I think we should be clear that the context of any accommodation request for minorities is one of gendered racism and structural rather than personal or occasional discrimination. And by this I mean, and here I would have to disagree with Jacob and what he said in the last session, that T1, the first moment, is not the accommodation request, right? That accommodation request is happening in a context of structural discrimination. It's a legal measure to counter discrimination. But focusing on the problem of accommodation, or worse, the particular groups which putatively request it, means that the public discourse shifted from addressing racism a structural problem, well, to the extent that the public discourse has ever been about that, but anyway, it made that impossible, to locating social tensions in the targets of racism, right, rather than in structural racism and their reproduction in personal and occasional racism. So I want to end with a question which has to do with this notion of reconciliation that that they advance. Is it a time for reconciliation? That's my question to you. How have we even dealt with any of these conflicts? Or have we addressed any of these needs or issues that immigrant, migrant, and racialized communities have brought to the table, partly in this commission process? Whom does the appeal or the injunction to reconcile interpolate? Like, who should reconcile themselves to whom or what? That's not clear to me after reading the report more than once. And what is the basis for reconciliation? Are the policy and other recommendations the authors make to be seen as the kind of basis for reconciliation, its prerequisite, its result? It's unclear. So to reformulate a question many people were asking about accommodation throughout this debate, what does reconciliation really mean? And, you know, I leave lots of time for us to discuss this and any other sort of questions that you might have or comments you might have to give some kind of conclusion to this. But I realize that it's not a very conclusive question. It's rather one that points to the need actually for further public discussion and for shifting the terms or the terrain of this discussion. So I'm happy to moderate the discussion if people want to just give some closing thoughts or closing comments.
Thanks. That was really terrific. Considering you did that on the fly, on the basis of that was really great, and I think we'll generate food for thought beyond, you know, the time that we have left for discussion here. I want to make a picky point, though, a little picky point, because I think it's actually important. My theme throughout these things has been how much confusion was elicited by the commissioners in deciding to go beyond their mandate, right? You can question about whether this was the right mandate whether this was the most important thing for the government to spend $5 million on, right? And I really think that it wasn't, and we've heard a lot of why that's the case, you know. But once the mandate was given, there are reasons both of strategy and of principle to stay within the mandate. Now, you said something which was right, absolutely, and tended to get forgotten again and again and again, and one thing which I didn't agree with about reasonable accommodation, the thing that you said that was, you know, I mean, it just had to be reemphasized and somehow it just got lost time and time again, is that reasonable accommodation is not a question of the largesse of the majority towards minorities, of being nice, generous, it's the law. Right? It is the law. And unless, unless we view the Charter as a kind of generous concession that we're making to people, you can't see it as anything other than the law. So, but then the thing that, so that needed repeating time and time again. The thing that I disagree with you a little bit is the idea that reasonable accommodation is a response in the law to discrimination. It isn't. What reasonable accommodation is a response to is the fact, because it is a fact, that different people will be impacted differently by laws and regulations in the workplace or in public institutions. And that there comes a point where those differentials might give rise to an unreasonable constraint, right? So the paradigm case comes from, you know, people with mobility, with different mobility requirements, pregnant women, et cetera, et cetera. But then it gets extended where you say, well, after all, you know, it could be that forcing someone to either forego salary or work on the Sabbath is an unreasonable constraint. So that actually is something that even the privileged majority can find itself in certain circumstances requiring accommodation because of certain aspects of their beliefs. So one of the things that, you know, again, tended to get lost in the vacarme of the commission was that if you look at the last few years of the work of the commission, the Commission des droits de la personne et de la jeunesse, where ultimately these complaints will go if they don't get settled in the workplace, you'll see a stunning number, the proportion, I'm bad at, very bad at numbers being a philosopher, the proportion that come from people whose names are, you know, Blanchard or something, you know. people whose names, betoken their appartenance to the majority. So what you get, for example, just to give an example, is a lot of claims made by evangelical Christian parents, but of Quebecois, you know, like lapsed Catholics who went over to some evangelical faith, who wanted their kids not to have to do sex ed, or who wanted their kids not to have to learn about evolution, right? So, I mean, then the thing gets debated on its merits, but the fact that tends to get forgotten is that people, all of whom have particularities that may at some point make it the case that living under a certain administrative rule may make it more difficult for me rather than for you rather than for me, we are all, as it were, on the same side of this. We can all at some point be in a position where reasonable accommodation is something that we will need to appeal to. That makes it into an even more limited instrument it's a very limited instrument, and it doesn't address at all, you know, discrimination and things like that, which leads me back to the first point of my intervention. This may not, at the end of the day, have been the most important thing for the government to spend $5 million on. It was the thing that was electorally required for the Liberal Party of the time, and it was the thing that the majority community was clamoring about. But it's really to do with this little technical thing. It's a legal doctrine. It's a legal doctrine that doesn't even really, at the end of the day, pretend to have anything much to do with discrimination. So that's a little point on which I disagree.
So Abigail, do you want to go? Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to say before, I don't know, Anna, if you want to respond, but one of the things that I wanted to put out actually a couple of days ago, and the point has passed, and Daniel has nicely plucked it back in from the past into right on the table, is the report mentions that the doctrine of reasonable accommodation in Canada is drawn from labor law. And I would point everybody to a wonderful article by Sheila Day and Gwen Brodsky that was written just post-charter about the doctrine of reasonable accommodation and labor law and criticizing it from a feminist perspective. Because what that article suggests, and I think that it's a good suggestion, is that reasonable accommodation to undue hardship exists against the background of what would be reasonable for a business that is structured in a particular way and that has a profit motive and a need for profit. So there are all these background conditions operating. When you take it into the field of civil society and cultural integration, the question of what are the constraints in the background that we would find unreasonable leads precisely to Anna's point about structural discrimination. That is, if those background conditions, I mean, I hope they're not profit, but maybe they are. I mean, they could be all sorts of things, but would actually fundamentally require that society to rethink how it's thinking about religion, how it has a historically constrained understanding of what freedom is that completely leaves out a number of people who were maybe pre-Enlightenment people who don't derive their traditions from the Enlightenment, that is problematic. And I think that is where the structural problem is. And it's in reasonable accommodation. It's right in the doctrine, in the law.
Do you want to respond or? No. First, thank you so much for this conclusion. I thought it was just absolutely great and so synthetic and analytical. I think you did an amazing job. And just to follow up, I think you gave a distorted view of the relationship between reasonable accommodation and anti-discrimination, because there is the idea of somehow, with all the limits that you pointed in the labor law, that it is some kind of redress for indirect discrimination. So you can, and for example, in EU law, it exists only for disability, and it is totally as a measure that is articulated to a notion of indirect discrimination that is having a structural impact on a group. And so you're giving us an individualistic vision of reasonable accommodation that everybody could actually ask for that. But for example, in EU law, no, it's disabled. And if we had to extend it, it would be only people who are bearers of the characteristic that are prohibited from discrimination, such as gender, race. Like, you have to be part of a group that is structurally affected indirectly by something that looks neutral. So, I mean, I'm talking about EU law, right? But so I think reasonable accommodation can take place inside that anti-discrimination framework. So it could actually be a very progressive judicial tool, but it depends on the judicial interpretation context that's going to give us the doctrine about that. So, and so just to finish, I think there's a great, without talking about reasonable accommodation, but just that idea, reasonable accommodation could be one of the formula that we have to actually complexify legally our understanding of equality. We used to have formal equality, we got discrimination, indirect discrimination, structural discrimination, etc. So we're complexifying because as sociologists, you know, become more intelligent, they give legal scholars the tool to develop new ways and new mechanisms to actually address how inequality is produced. So reasonable accommodation could be interpreted as the outcome of that process, but it can also be, you know, diluted into this kind of, oh, it's, I just want to be accommodated and it's my preference or whatever, this kind of liberal individualistic way. But it really depends, I guess, on the legal doctrine that's going to happen. And I think it's a problem, or, well, it's a problem, but I just wanted to mention that a legal scholar, Martha Minow, wrote a great book in 1990 making all the difference about how to accommodate difference in institutions that used to be based, that seem neutral, but, you know, are actually, as you said, Anna, like just like perpetuating majority norms, and that it's like, you know, giving special treatment or changing the norm. So what we need to do is change the norm, and obviously the report doesn't really address that issue.
Well, and that's not to say that the beneficiaries of this kind of legal doctrine can't be members of the majority group in some way. Because that's in fact what has happened, for instance, in the United States with anti-discrimination law, is that the cases that are, the majority of cases that win anti-discrimination law are white men claimants. I mean, that is a really, should give us pause, right? Because the effects of that are not really the intent of it in terms of this institutional design.
So I think we may be talking at cross purposes about reasonable accommodation. I mean, I'm not disagreeing about the fact about the background. I mean, compare reasonable accommodation as it occurs within Canadian law, right, to something like the doctrine of strict scrutiny in the United States. So what strict scrutiny says is that there are certain categorizations of people that we know antecedently and historically have put them in a position of hardship, discrimination. So, you know, in the United States, obviously, African-American is the main thing. So we're going to look at laws. If they impact on people differentially, where the differential does not track one of those historically discriminated against groups, well, we're going to apply one kind of standard. You know, we're going to allow that sometimes, you know, different measures are going to affect different people differently, and we're going to let that stand. You know, if there's no, unless we can see some intent with categories that are in strict scrutiny, we're not going to even bother looking for intent, right? If it affects, that's the doctrine. And so there's nothing analogous to strict scrutiny in the doctrine of reasonable accommodation. Maybe there should be, right? What I'm saying is what there is, not what there should be. Reasonable accommodation basically says there is a point at which some rule may end up bearing down on a person in an unreasonable manner, given a particular right about that person. And it says nothing about what, as it would be if it were a kind of a, you know, attempting to alleviate historical inequalities and hierarchies within the society. It says nothing about where the bounds of those particularities are. So, of course, evangelical, you know, white parents are going to try to use it as a tool, because there it is. I mean, what I'm saying basically is that, to conclude, if we want to address the structural discrimination that we want to address, reasonable accommodation is not the right tool. It's just not the right tool.
Hi, I'm David from McGill, Political Science. This is the same point I was going to raise in the earlier discussion about the specific particulars with Quebec in regards to discrimination and racism, and the way the conversation veered from accommodation to systemic racism in society as a whole. Professor Weinstock mentioned that $5 billion could be spent on something different in society to sort of get rid of some of the discrimination that occurs. And I was kind of wondering if we could expand the discussion in terms of what is going on in Quebec currently to combat discrimination, either by employers or by normative views or whatnot. I did some research on Quebec myself, and it's interesting to see the convergence of Quebec in the way it sees itself as a minority in North America, linguistically and culturally. And does this influence the way it views minorities with its own society? And this perhaps makes it a special case, comparing it to anti-discriminatory policy in English Canada or America, perhaps. And on a side point, I forget my side point. Anyways, I felt like we sort of went into a discussion of systemic racism, and if there's a way we could talk about if there was a second commission that was mentioned to combat these kind of issues, what points could it make? What current policies could it expand upon in terms of interculturalism, in terms of, there was the Montreal Action Week against racism in March. And is there anything special about the case in Quebec in particular that might make it a little trickier than, say, doing policies like this elsewhere in North America?
I mean, I think One of the problems with the commission, I think, I was a little bit discouraged at Charles Taylor's reaction yesterday when he said, you know, it did calm things down, right? But what it did, you know, the report calmed things down, even if none of the recommendations are adopted. The very having of the process, in a way, calmed things down. And that's true, but the people that had calmed down were basically the members of the majority who'd gotten excited, right? And so they kind of, you know, calmed down. They got to say their piece during 13 commission hearings in the regions. And, you know, maybe they came to realize that worrying about frosted windows and no pork in the beans and whatnot is a little bit silly. And when you say it out loud, it actually sounds sillier than when you're just kind of... So it did calm things down. But then, I mean, the worst thing that could happen as a result of the report is to say, everything's okay now, right? Everything's okay now because the majority is no longer exercised about sugar shacks and frosted windows. Everything isn't okay, and you know, 25% of the 2.5 times the provincial rate of unemployment amongst visible minorities is not okay. So I don't know what's happening on the ground. You know, there are some things that came out of the report to do with recognition of foreign credentials, which, you know, by the way, recognition of foreign credentials is not a new theme. It's a theme that's been around. Everybody says at various points when these things kind of emerge, you know, we have to do something to recognize foreign credentials, and then nothing happens because the forces that are aligned against that happening in civil society are enormous. You know, you're talking about corporatism. Professional corporatism, where people are guarding very jealously the ability to confer the proper accreditation on, you know, to be an engineer, to be a teacher, to be this, to be that, and you know, that's a formidable thing to go up against. You know, I mean, the same kind of corporatism is blocking healthcare reform in the United States to some degree, right? And you realize just how difficult that is to stop. So, I mean, I don't know exactly what's going on. I think that the worry that I would have as a result of all this process is that we've made ourselves feel good about ourselves, in a way. We've taken a situation that was tense and made it less tense, but only because the people who have the ability to give the appearance, right, because they control the media outlets, they are the majority, that things are not okay, have been sort of placated. So, I mean, I would very much like there to be a commission of this kind on employment integration for immigrants and not-so-recent arrivals in Quebec, but I don't see it on the horizon.
I guess one thing I was thinking about, something that I thought I heard Anna saying is different from the distinction you wanted to draw. So you wanted to say that reasonable accommodation is perhaps not the best way to address racism. And one thing I heard Anna say, and you can... is that reasonable accommodation is a symptom of racism, which is different. So that the very structure of or how one perceives the problem, and then the ways in which racism can be disclosed both by the process and by the drafters of the document is a different issue. So it may disclose a problem or maybe even animate a problem that it's obviously not equipped to address if it's structurally embedded in the institutional practice.
Martin, here?
I'm going to talk, Daniel, as a Blanchard, evangelical Catholic, even though I really appreciated today's discussion. It was very, very interesting. But I'm going to talk in English, but I should have talking French here, being a Blanchard, but I'm going to take just Blanchard. Yeah, that's it, or white car, if you wish. I'm going to try to understand also what was behind the majority. We haven't had much discussion about that. We had a lot of critiques how the commission was framed, how the report was done, the conclusion of the report, but there was also, and also how the media and some parties in Quebec took hold of this problem. But there was also, and Jacob hinted to that, something about the projet identitaire québécois that was behind that didn't work through referendums. And now there's something like an anxiety in the in the majority, what will happen to us? What will happen? We haven't been able to secure our identity through referendum, through building a country, and what will happen to us? I mean, that's not to the to this majority, and I think it's gonna come back, and it's probably gonna come back. What I see is about the debate I hear a lot now is about language, and the Parti Québécois is gonna come back, and there's probably gonna be something like the anxieties that we saw 2 years ago that haven't really been alleviated. Some like the populist fraction of those anxieties have been dealt with by the report, but the what some have called the malaise identitaire or the projet identitaire has not been through with the referendums, it's going to come back, and it might come back through the language questions, and this might be something for the future after the commission.
Any other questions, comments? No. You're just like, let us loose. Yeah, okay. It's an ongoing discussion, yeah. Clearly.
Could we thank the organizers?
Okay. Well, thank you.